You're listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Yeah, well, as we've been talking this morning here on a Throwback Thursday, that college football is going through a lot of changes and a lot of adjustments. It's not really news, but how it's doing that kind of is. Shion Jayaraja joins us from CBS Sports to talk about this and really kind of put into context a couple of things that are in the news. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good. Did I get your name right? Because you do a good job of doing the phonetic pronunciation of your name on Twitter.
Pretty close. Pretty close. So it's Shion Jayaraja. Yeah.
Shion?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Very good. I want to get it right because you put a lot of effort into it. I should also put a lot of effort in it to get your name correct. So I want to ask you about this. Let's start with the divisions. We see the Pac-12 going divisionless now. We're going to see the ACC was discussing it, this sort of 5-5-3 model or how they're putting it together. What's the benefit of this? Why are these conferences doing that?
Well, I think that the biggest reason is, when you look from the Pac-12's perspective, over the past 11 years, five of their championship games did not feature the two best teams in the conference. I think that it's easy to go look back, especially at 2011 and 2012, when Oregon and Stanford were clearly the two best teams in the league, both top five type programs, and those two teams were unable to play in the championship game. And I think that a lot of conferences, especially the Pac-12 and ACC, I think look at what the Big 12 has done, where they guarantee themselves a quality matchup at the end of the year because they play 1v2, and it's been pretty successful for them. The Big 12 has had, since they instituted that title game, three playoff teams. And so I think that that from a conference title game perspective, that's a big part of it. But the other side of it, too, is that it really frees up your scheduling. And you mentioned the ACC potentially moving to a 3-5-5. The big one is going to be when the SEC decides what it wants to do, because the reality is with 16 teams going to 2 8-team divisions, doesn't make it much sense for anybody, especially when you play an 8-game conference schedule. That would only be one crossover game a year. So I think that we're inevitably going to move towards some of these bigger conferences, especially having common opponents and having a rotating rest of the schedule, just so that you can maximize the amount of times that you play different teams each year.
So does that ruin some traditional in-conference rivalries? Will they be able to still, like Oregon State, will they just be able to play all the time no matter what, or will that sort of force it out of the hands of the schools?
Sure. Well, so from a Pac-12 perspective, they're still talking about sort of what they want to do long-term. They basically just said, look, we want to get this done with as soon as possible. And a big part of that, by the way, is that Utah and USC might be the two best teams in the Pac-12, and they're both in the South, so they might have a chance to play each other again. But you bring up a good point. So I think that the model that we seem to be moving towards seems to be having a permanent common opponent type structure. And, so for example, like you mentioned, Oregon is going to play Oregon State every year. That's going to be written in stone. I think that you look around the country, Alabama is going to always play Auburn every year. Michigan's always going to play Ohio State, you would imagine. Texas and Oklahoma, you think, are always probably going to play. So I think that they're going to do a lot of stuff to try to protect those rivalries. The models that we've seen, again, like with the ACC, is having three common opponents every single year. So, for example, for North Carolina, it might be Duke and North Carolina State and maybe somebody else, right? So I think that sort of system makes a lot of sense. And it does ensure that you protect a certain amount of games. Now, the reality is, a lot of these teams have played each other every single year for the past, 20 years at this point. But I think that, it's going to be a moment where, one, you kind of protect the things that are most dear to you, and two, I think is another opportunity to create some new rivalries as well heading forward.
I want to ask you about Nick Saban's comments and your thoughts on them, because we don't know what's in Saban's head, but where do you think he was directing those comments towards? Was he like looking at the business leaders of Birmingham, like, wink, wink, I could need some help? Or was he actually making a statement on the state of college football and saying, I don't know where this is going, and I'm not a big fan of it?
A little of this, a little of that, I think. I think that, Nick Saban is obviously the most powerful voice in college football by a pretty wide margin. And so I think that that there definitely is a factor of talking to administrators, of talking to the NCAA and saying, hey guys, is this what we're doing here? Is this the rules right now? Is this how we want to do it? But I definitely think that when you're talking to a group of boosters like Nick Saban was, that's always going to be a part of it, right? It's going to be, hey, this is what we need to succeed. And when you look at what set Nick Saban apart at Alabama, it is his ability to kind of get everybody rowing in the same direction, everybody on the same page. And I think that he's been one of the best in the country at doing that over quite literally the past 20 years. And so I do think that that is a factor that cannot be ignored in all of this, is the fact that he was making this comment to a slate of boosters. But you know, I mean, he knew that he was being recorded. He knew that there was reporters in the room. And so I think that this was something that he was comfortable sort of elevating as well in some sort of way. So we'll kind of see what happens. I mean, what's going to be really interesting is that, you know, obviously the Jimbo Fisher part is going to be the part that's taken away most by sort of, you know, the talking people, I guess you could say. And so I'm curious to see, you know, does Jimbo Fisher respond? Deion Sanders says he's going to respond. You know, does this kind of become a situation where the direction is maybe the bigger story than what he actually said? And so I'm curious to see how Nick Saban also follows up on this, because this was sort of candid, you know, somewhat offhand comments. It's going to be interesting to see how he kind of responds to it when he's put in sort of an interview setting.
Do you think, and I'm asking you to speculate here, do you think when he said Texas A&M bought every player, what he means Texas A&M as like the entire collective, the boosters, everybody that sort of has a finger in the program? Or is he talking about the school? Because if he's talking about the school, that's a problem.
Yeah, I think that's you know, I've made this comparison before, right? Collectives are super PACs. They are groups that, quote-unquote, aren't affiliated with candidates, but in reality, obviously, I think that we all know that they are, and you know, that there's influence and coordination and all that sort of stuff. And so I think that all this sort of stuff is quote-unquote collective-based. It is, you know, signing with the collective, it's like a contract like that, which, by the way, I mean, the NCAA explicitly put out guidelines the other day saying actually collectives aren't in the spirit of our rules, and you know, and we'll enforce that. But the reality is too is that if the NCAA is going to say one thing and not enforce it, then rules don't exist, right? I mean, yeah. If you don't enforce laws, then there are no laws. And so I think it's going to be really interesting, you know, whether it is you know, whether the NCAA eventually does come knocking. And I think that, you know, for Texas A&M, they did things within the spirit of the rules that existed at the time. The question is going to be, you know, long-term, is this something that's cracked down on it? But, you know, it hasn't happened to this point. So I think the reality is, right, there are so many middlemen. I mean, I got this question kind of in a similar way about tampering the other day. You know, is there tampering? Well, you know, I don't think that Nick Saban is talking to Jordan Addison before he enters the portal, but I mean, he has other, middlemen, you know, who certainly are able to have this, you know, even if it's other players, even if it's talking to high school coaches, even if it's talking to family. I mean, there's just so many people in between every step of this process, and for good reason, that, you know, it's like with collectives. You can have some level of plausible deniability that you're involved, but the reality is, I mean, you are in control of your program and everybody knows what's happening.
Has anybody come up with a good answer to this NIL? Because it seems like we all knew this would eventually come down like this, right? Like, we all kind of went, you know what? This is wild. It's going to be the wild, wild west out there. And it's sure enough, that's kind of what it looked like. But the reality of it is that student athletes have been fighting for this for years. The Ed O'Bannon thing has led to a number of student athletes going, wait a minute. You're selling my jersey, or you're selling a hat with a hairstyle that I have. I got to get a cut of this. You're selling my picture on a t-shirt. It's a hard fought victory for them, and if I can't imagine any rule that doesn't hurt them in their pursuit of getting what they fought for.
I think that there are two sides to this, right? And there's sort of you know, a path with two directions that we can go. And one side of it is enforcement. It is the NCAA saying collectives shouldn't exist, you know, inducement shouldn't exist, because a lot of state laws also, by the way, explicitly ban inducements. But we're seeing this happen, obviously, through collectives especially, and nobody's really done anything about it. So either we need to have enforcement of rules that already exist. We don't need new rules. There are rules that already exist on the books that aren't being enforced. Or the other side of it, if we want to move in this other direction, which for the record, as somebody who covers the sport and who's also obviously a big fan of college football, I'm fine either direction we choose. But the other direction that we go to is moving towards it being an employment contract model. And I think that that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you have to sign players to millions or anything like that, but I think that it does mean that when you sign contracts, it needs to be somewhat public. There needs to be set terms. You know, I think a big part of it is if you, you know, the one way that you can restrict player movement per se is if they collectively bargain it, if they do agree to a contract, if they do agree to rules. But, you know, I think what is bad for the sport right now is, like you said, having this sort of free-for-all, because, you know, everybody wants to talk about this in the context of being like a truly free market. We don't know prices. We don't know rules. We don't know contracts. And that sort of stuff, you know, it sounds great when you talk about it in the context of a free market. But, you know, what we love in America isn't just pure free market. It's having regulated markets where there are rules and guidelines and, you know, where you aren't allowed to sort of just jump in and, you know, after something goes good, you know, you shouldn't be able to go and just take a player after a certain year, right? So I think that those are the two paths that we have. We can either enforce the rules about inducements that we have right now, which doesn't honestly seem especially likely to me, or we need to start moving towards more of an employment-based, contract-based model where you can put limitations on players, but it's because they're signing something that also guarantees them something too.
Shayan Jayaraja, thank you so much. That is some informative stuff. I really do appreciate your time this morning helping us sort a lot of this stuff out because, man, it's making news every single day.
No question. I think we're all ready for football itself to come back soon.
We certainly are. Thank you so much, my friend. We hope to get you on again soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
You got it. On a Progressive guest line, Progressive Insurance, making bundling home and auto easy. Learn more at progressive.com. Hey, also a reminder, you know, it's summer, so you're looking for some projects, right? You're going to get some stuff out of the garage, get some things going, get some lawn stuff working. Whatever it is you may be doing, you're going to need Freol Deep Penetrating Oil because it delivers 3 times more lubricant, so it's going to take less spray, less torque, and less time than any other penetrating oil to get those rusted machine screws undone, rusty pliers, other tools, corroded U-bolts, the axle nut removals that you're going to need. Freol Deep Penetrating Oil can be found at AutoZone, O'Reilly, Napa Auto Parts Store, as well as select Walmart stores. And again, it's also body shop safe, so it means it's safe on paint, plastic parts, and it's silicone free. I use it. You should too. Freol Deep Penetrating Oil. Again, 3 times more lubricant. Less time means less spray. Less spray means less time means less torque. And that's a good thing. Freol Deep Penetrating Oil. We'll come back. Some thoughts on what he was talking about coming up as we continue with Sports Map Radio.